Exodus chapter 6, verse 1, to chapter 7, verse 7, the 10th talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on December 13, 2015, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 10, Exodus chapter 6, verse 1 to chapter 7, verse 7, accompanies this talk.
We'll be looking at the 6th chapter of Exodus. What has happened just preceding where we are here at the beginning of chapter 6 is Moses went to Pharaoh. He had already gone to the elders of Israel and they had believed the signs. So Moses and Aaron were going with their blessing. Moses and Aaron go to speak to Pharaoh and they tell him what God had told them and told Pharaoh to let them go. And Pharaoh's response was quite harsh, not even a possibility. He wasn't going to allow them to go. And in fact, he was going to respond to this as a rebellion born of laziness. That's what he thought was happening. And so he was going to use overwhelming force to address the problem. That is, they were going to have to not only make the number of bricks that they had been making, but they had to gather their own straw to make those bricks with. So the Israelite foremen who are working for Pharaoh, keeping the Israelites in line, they got punished when the Israelites did not meet their quotas. So the foreman went and they talked to Pharaoh and said, something got messed up here because we've been asked to do something that's impossible and we have been faithful to you, we have been good servants to you, and we got flogged because we didn't meet the quota and the quota can't be met. Pharaoh, instead of saying, oh yeah, there was a mistake, and modifying the arrangement that he had made, he said, you are lazy, very lazy. I will not back down. So the foremen leave that meeting and they talk to Moses and Aaron, and they are adamant that Moses and Aaron got them into this mess. And they want God to judge Moses and Aaron for what they have done. As a result, Moses goes away distraught because this is the very thing. This is the worst case scenario. This is exactly what Moses did not want to happen, that he would go and be thoroughly rejected by his people and not be able to provide the leadership that was necessary. And he has gone and tried to provide that leadership, and things have gotten worse, not better. So Moses then appeals to God, and there are two things that he emphasizes. One is, what are you doing? What's going on here? Things have gotten worse rather than better. And the second is, why'd you send me? Why'd you drag me into this thing? And then he says, my actions have brought no deliverance. They've only brought greater harm. So that's Moses kind of expressing his frustrations to God. So at the beginning of chapter 6, then, we have God's response to what Moses has said. The first verse, we'll start with that one. Then the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For under compulsion he shall let them go, and under compulsion he shall drive them out of his land. His response is only a partial response to what Moses had asked him, but essentially what he's saying is that there are some things that God wants to accomplish in order to set things up for the Exodus to come. And one thing that he wants to accomplish is he wants Pharaoh to be doing something that is against his will. He wants to get Pharaoh in a position where Pharaoh is adamantly opposed to the thing that God is asking to do. And Pharaoh, being the most powerful man on earth at the time, or at least close to it, and a man who is thought to be God, is going to be put into a situation where he is forced to comply with God's wishes, even though he really doesn't want to do it. So God is hardening Pharaoh's opposition in order that he can bring out the wonders that he wants to use and the judgments that he wants to use to force Pharaoh's hand. The other thing that he wants to do that's kind of implied here is prepare the Israelites for leaving. They've been in slavery in Egypt, but there has been an upside to that. And that is, they have been cared for. They have had food to eat. And later on, it's going to become clear, they're going to look back at that with fondness. There was an upside there. And God, just before the Exodus, wants to make things as bitter as possible so that they will indeed leave. He's going to set things up so that Pharaoh drives them out. And there's a sense in which they have to be driven out because there will be a little foot dragging. But God's going to minimize that foot dragging by making things truly miserable right at the end. The next section, verses 2 through 9. God spoke further to Moses and said to him, "I am the Lord, and I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, Lord, I did not make myself known to them. And I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they sojourned. And furthermore, I have heard the groaning of the sons of Israel, because the Egyptians are holding them in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the sons of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage. I will also redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. Then I will take you for my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you for a possession, for I am the Lord." So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage. So God speaks, and what he's doing here is basically giving a statement of what he is going to do. It's not a full detailed account of all the things that God is going to do, but it lists all of his goals, all of the major things he wants to accomplish in this event. He starts out saying, "I am the Lord," that is, "I am Yahweh," and he ends this with, "I am Yahweh." That seems to be a commonly used literary device to set something off, some piece, as a unit. So what we have here is a unit that's being spoken that begins with "I am Yahweh" and ends with "I am Yahweh." Now he says "I am Yahweh" about 4 or 5 times in this passage. That is clearly an emphasis here. "I am Yahweh." He explains that he is the same God that had appeared to the patriarchs. He's the same God that appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But when he had appeared to them, he had appeared in another capacity. He had appeared as El Shaddai, that is, God Almighty. I'm not sure what the significance of El Shaddai is. It's used a number of times, but not extremely frequently. But that is the name by which he most frequently refers to himself in Genesis, in the patriarchal account. What Umberto Casuto argues is that the name indicates the capacity or the function that is being identified with the god. And that's a typical ancient Near Eastern cultural trait. That is, their gods frequently had several names, and different names would be used depending on which aspect of their god they wanted to highlight at the time. I'm going to read, this is about a paragraph out of Umberto Casuto. It's actually longer than that, but I chopped it down. But it's still a little lengthy, so hang in there with me. "The people of the Orient used to attribute to each of their gods a variety of names and qualities, and they associated with each designation specific concepts and characteristics. In the Egyptian texts, for example, it is stated that a certain deity is accustomed to do one kind of work under such a name, another kind of work under a different appellation, and a third task under yet another title, and so forth. With the name El Shaddai, the Israelites were wont to associate the idea of the divinity who rules over nature and bestows upon mankind fertility, as we can see from every verse in the Pentateuch in which this name occurs. And he gives four examples of that. This enables us to see the text before us clearly. I revealed myself, God declares, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in my aspect that finds expression in the name Shaddai. And I made them fruitful and multiplied them and gave them children and children's children. But by the name Yahweh, in my character as expressed by this designation, I was not known to them. That is, it was not given to them to recognize me as one that fulfills promises, because the assurance with regard to the possession of the land, which I had given them, I had not yet fulfilled. Although one of the attributes connected with the Tetragrammaton, that's Yahweh, the name Yahweh, the attribute of being with his creatures, was fulfilled also in the patriarchs, yet in the implementation of the meaning of this name, namely that he is the one who carries out his promises, God was not known to the fathers of the nation. So what Umberto Casuto is arguing is that the name El Shaddai is used when they want to emphasize God's being there with his people, and in particular, providing them with offspring, the offspring that were necessary in order to carry on the blessings. But that same God made promises to them, and the name Yahweh underscores God in his capacity of fulfilling the promises that he has made. And he was not known to them by that name because he hadn't yet fulfilled the promises, in particular, the promise of giving them the land. So they hadn't known him in that capacity because that had not happened. But now, in Exodus, we are being introduced to God as Yahweh, the one who fulfills his promises, and he is going to go on to fulfill that particular promise, the one of giving them the land. Okay. It says also in this text that I also established my covenant with them. And it's interesting that covenant is in plural here, suggesting that even though God spoke to the patriarch and made promises on several occasions, for the purposes of this text, it's looking at it as one thing. So despite some variations between the different times that God appeared and gave and made his covenant, his promises to the patriarchs, it's being looked at as one. And God has decided that now is the time to act. He has heard the groanings of the Israelites. He has remembered the promises that he has made. And now is the time that he is going to move to fulfill the promises that he has made. He repeats then, in verse 6, I am the Lord, I am Yahweh. And that is followed by seven verbs where God is the subject of each of those verbs. There are seven verbs. There are four followed by a fifth that really is just expanding upon the fourth. And then there are two others that follow that. So we'll talk about the first four verbs. The first one is, I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. So he's listing all of the things that he is going to do in the process of this Exodus. And the first is, he's going to bring them out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. This verb, to bring out, is often used with respect to liberation. And so the idea here seems to be, I am going to liberate you from your slavery. So that's the first of the things that he is going to accomplish. The second is, I will deliver you from their bondage. Deliver you, this is in the sense of I will remove you. So if there's liberation, and then the second one is a removal. He's going to take them out. The third is I will also redeem you. The word for redemption here comes from a concept in Israel. We see it in the law. And that is that a kinsman has a responsibility to come to the aid of his kinsman when they are in need. One of the most common examples is when they go into the land is divided up, different pieces of land is given to each tribe, and then within that tribe, each family gets a piece of land. And that land becomes the property of that family in perpetuity. They are supposed to hold on to that. That is the land that's been given to them. Now, if things happen such that a family is put into a situation where they have no choice but to sell a piece of that land or sell the whole land, that there is an obligation on the part of a kinsman who can to come along and buy that land so that it stays within the family, that it stays the inheritance of the family. And that's called redeeming the land. In this case, God, a close kinsman, is coming to redeem his people, to get them out of slavery. So there's liberation, there's deliverance, there's redemption, and then the fourth one is, I will take you for my people. So here, God is going to be allied with his people, uniquely identified with them. It says, I will take you for my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. So I will take you, and I will be your God. Those are generally taken to be synonymous. They both have the same idea behind them. That is, God is going to have a unique relationship with his people. And something that I did not know that's pointed out by Sarna is that some of the language that is used here is language that's associated with marriage. So it is suggesting that the unique relationship here is marriage-like, that God will be the God of the Israelites, and the Israelites will accept him as their God. There will be mutual loyalty there. Okay, so those are the first four of what turns out to be essentially six verbs. And these, at Passover, in celebrating the Passover meal, it is the custom in Jewish culture to drink four drinks at that meal. And the rabbis say that those four drinks are for these four verbs that describe what God is going to do. Why it is that they single those four out and don't have the next two, I don't know. But the next two have to do with what he's going to do after they get out of Egypt. The first one in verse 8, I will bring you to the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he's going to take them through the wilderness and take them to the threshold of that land. And then the last verb, I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord. So he's going to give them the land that he had promised to give to them, and now it will be theirs not to sojourn in, but to actually possess. Okay, so those are the six things that God lists that he will accomplish in the Exodus that is to come. Verse 9 is heartbreaking. If you can identify with Moses at all, this is heartbreaking. Because it says, so Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage. So Moses delivered to the people the message that God had told him to, and their response is they did not listen. If you'll recall, the end of chapter 4, verse 31, it says, so he performs all the signs, and then 31 it says, so the people believed. And when they had heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshipped, So that's really encouraging for Moses at the time. But clearly, given the events that have occurred since then, that belief that's expressed there, that goes by the wayside. And now, as a result of the situation that they are in, there is no belief. Moses tells the Israelites exactly what God had told him to tell them, and they don't believe, and it's because they are despondent over their situation. The next section. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the sons of Israel go out of his land." But Moses spoke before the Lord, saying, "Behold, the sons of Israel have not listened to me. How then will Pharaoh listen to me? For I am unskilled in speech." Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, and gave them a charge to the sons of Israel and to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. So in the face of the Israelites' rejection of Moses' word at this point in time, God doesn't say, "Well, go back and try again." He just says, "Move on. I want you to go speak to Pharaoh." So God is sending Moses to speak to Pharaoh, and again to tell Pharaoh to let God's people go and let them leave Egypt. In response to this, Moses expresses a concern that he has expressed before, and that is that he's not the one to do this. And in particular, he's concerned about his eloquence. He's not eloquent enough. And I mentioned before, I mean, there's some people that say that it's stuttering that is his problem, and that's possible. But I think it's possible that it's not stuttering as much as it's he's just not impressive. In any case, he's saying, "The Israelites didn't even listen to me. There is no chance that Pharaoh is going to listen to what I have to say." And he says that because he's not impressive of speech. And he's thinking what's needed here is a powerful and impressive speaker. That's the only person that can do what needs to be done here. That is to win over the loyalty of the Israelites and to get Pharaoh to let God's people go. But God doesn't really respond to that here. It just says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a charge to the sons of Israel and to the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt." And the text then breaks off there, and the author decided at this point to insert some genealogical information. And then he's going to take up the narrative right where he left off. So I will read the genealogical information, which is full of names, and I apologize for any names that I mispronounce. "These are the heads of their fathers' households: the sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn, Hanok and Pallu, Hezron and Carmi. These are the families of Reuben. And the sons of Simeon: Jemuel and Jamin and Ohad and Jachin and Zohar and Shaul, the son of the Canaanite woman. These are the families of Simeon. And these are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations: Gershon and Kohath and Merari. And the length of Levi's life was 137 years. The sons of Gershon: Libni and Shimei according to their families. And the sons of Kohath: Amram and Izhar and Hebron and Uziel. And the length of Kohath's life was 133 years. And the sons of Merari: Mahli and Mushi. These are the families of the Levites according to their generations. And Amram married his father's sister, Jochebed, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. And the length of Amram's life was 137 years. And the sons of Izhar: Korah and Nepheg and Zikri. And the sons of Uziel: Mishael and Elzaphan and Sithri. And Aaron married Elisheba, the daughter of Aminadab, the sister of Nashon. And she bore him Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And the sons of Korah: Issir and Elkanah and Abiasaph. These are the families of the Korahites. And Aaron's son Eleazar married one of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Phinehas. These are the heads of the fathers' households of the Levites according to their families. It was the same Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, "Bring out the sons of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their hosts." They were the ones who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the sons of Israel from Egypt. It was the same Moses and Aaron. I read an interesting, it was a portion of a book that talks about genealogies in the Bible. And it argues that the genealogies in the Bible constitute a literary genre. That is to say, they are not just a routine listing of fathers and sons, but rather they are crafted to communicate something in the context of the text in which they occur. And this piece that I was reading was in particular talking about the genealogy in Matthew and talking about what's going on there and how that's being crafted. What the author pointed out is that it is common in genealogies for them to be abbreviated. That is, not every generation is listed. And there is a method to the madness of who is singled out to be included and who is omitted. And therefore, to understand what's going on, you have to pay attention to who is there and who is not there. You also have to pay attention to inclusions like wives, because it is unusual for a wife to be included in genealogy, but sometimes wives are included, and when they are, there's a reason for that. And the other thing is, there are any other comments about any of the people in the genealogy that needs to be taken very seriously. There's a reason why it's there. I cannot account for everything in this genealogy, but there are a few things that I find interesting and that might be pointing us in a direction as to why this genealogy is here. There are a few observations that I want to make. The first is just the general structure of it. It gives the first two generations of the first two sons of Jacob. So Reuben and Simeon, it gives them and their sons. So first son of Jacob and his sons, the second son of Jacob and his sons, and then Levi is the third son of Jacob and his sons. It goes no further. We don't have any of the other 12. We only have the first three. So it's clearly zeroing in on the tribe of Levi and locating him as the third born. The second thing is, it clearly is pointing to Aaron and Moses. It's highlighting what their ancestry is. And we have a little bit about Aaron's descendants. We have nothing about Moses's. They aren't here at all. The other thing is, if you draw it out on a piece of paper, which I did, is clearly pointing to two lines. One is that one of Aaron, and the other is the line that results in Korah and his sons. Those are the endpoints of this genealogy. Okay, there are a few points of interest that they strike me as interesting. I don't know exactly what to make of them. The first one is, it only gives the ages of three people, and those are all the direct ancestors of Moses and Aaron. I don't know why that is. The second thing, it takes one of the people in the genealogy, Shaul, and it points out that he was from a Canaanite mother. That's from the sons of Simeon, that Shaul was a Canaanite mother. I'm not sure why that's there. It could be suggesting that Simeon's line is not as pure as is the Levitical line. It could be that is pointing forward to what we'll see a statement later in Exodus, where it indicates very clearly that those people who left Egypt were not all descendants of Abraham. There were other people that were included in that group, and it could be that it's pointing ahead to that fact. The third point of interest, It has Amram marrying the sister of his father, and that's Jochebed. That's curious, because later in the law that's given to Moses, such a marriage would be prohibited. And yet the author has gone out of the way to point out that that was the situation. As I mentioned before, the children of Moses are not here, which is a very curious omission, and I really don't know what to make of that. The fifth point of interest is Aaron married Elisheba. Elisheba is the daughter of Aminadab, and Aminadab is a direct ancestor of David, and therefore a direct ancestor of Jesus. So the Levitical line and the Davidic line meet at this point. Okay, so those are points of interest. Now, what does this genealogy accomplish? Well, first it places Moses and Aaron in their genealogical context. It shows us where they come from, and that's critical. If you want to know somebody's identity in the ancient world, it's their genealogy. That gives you more information than their name or anything else. It identifies that family which would later become the priestly family, that is, the Levites, and in particular, Aaron and his descendants. The other thing it does is it locates individuals who were later involved in acts of rebelliousness. And there are three of those that stick out here. The first one is the sons of Aaron. It lists the sons of Aaron as Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. Nadab and Abihu were involved in an incident that's described in Leviticus 10, 1 through 7, in which they were to burn incense in the temple, and they took it upon themselves to burn incense that was not prescribed by God. Strange fire is what it's referred to. They burned strange fire before God. I don't know what the significance of that is, but they were clearly doing something that was in violation of what God had asked them to do. As a result, they were consumed with fire that came out from the incense pan. So there is the first act of rebellion that is hinted at in this genealogy. The second one, I think, is the most interesting, and that is Korah's rebellion. That's one of the endpoints of this genealogy, is Korah and his sons. And Korah was involved in a rebellion that is particularly relevant to Moses and the situation that we have seen here. That's recorded in Numbers 16, 1 through 40, but I'm just going to read the first three verses, Numbers 16, 1 through 3. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, and the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Pethel, sons of Reuben, took action. And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. And they assembled together against Moses and Aaron, and said to them, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So Korah's rebellion is one of challenging the authority of Moses and Aaron in a way that is very similar to the challenge that was given when Moses killed the Egyptian. Then he comes to break up a fight between two Israelites, and one of them says, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us?" The same kind of sentiment. And then it goes on to talk about Korah and his rebellion, and he too ends up dying. Then there's one more, the sin of Peor, which is recorded in Numbers 25, 1 through 18. It's in a situation where the Israelites have been openly violating the law that God has given and intermarrying with some of the locals. And one of the grandson of Aaron takes a spear and runs through one of the offender and the woman from the area who was not an Israelite. He ran them through with a spear and killed them. And that stopped the plague that was being inflicted upon the Israelites. So it's three acts of rebellion that are, I think, being highlighted in this genealogy, indicating that the rebelliousness that we have seen up to now, that is not going to automatically go away when they leave Egypt and go into the wilderness. That kind of behavior will continue, including the challenge to Moses' authority. And yet, as we see with Phinehas, there are bright spots in that story that there are individuals who will act righteously in the midst of that. Okay, the rest of chapter 6. Now it came about on the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, that the Lord spoke to Moses saying, I am the Lord, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I speak to you. But Moses said before the Lord, behold, I am unskilled in speech. How then will Pharaoh listen to me? This is essentially what was said before the genealogy. I think this is just the author's way of picking up the story where he had left off. I don't think there's anything new here of significance. All right, the first section of chapter 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, see, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh, that he let the sons of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. So Moses and Aaron did it as the Lord commanded them, thus they did. And Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. So here God is addressing again Moses' concern about not being eloquent. And he says something that's very similar to what he had said before. And that is, he's essentially ignoring the problem that Moses has raised, because that's not a real problem. The problem Moses has raised is, I'm not impressive enough. From God's perspective, that's irrelevant. And God just tells him, I am going to set you up. You, Moses, will be to Aaron like I, God, am to you, Moses. And Aaron will speak what you tell him to speak to Pharaoh, just as you, Moses, a prophet, receiving words from me, speak that to the people. So Aaron is going to be set up in a prophet-like status with respect to Pharaoh. And Moses will tell him what to say. And Pharaoh is not going to listen to what you have to say. You can know that already. Pharaoh isn't going to be won over. Pharaoh is going to refuse to do what I ask him to do, and he will just become more stubborn. And I am doing that because I want to multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. I've set things up so that there will be a maximum amount of resistance to my commands, and I will pull out all the stops as I liberate my people from the land of Egypt. And when he does so, when he brings all of his people out of Egypt, the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. So in the midst of these great judgments, they are going to know who God is, that God is Yahweh. And if you remember back when Moses and Aaron first spoke to Pharaoh, Pharaoh said, who's Yahweh? Well, now they will know that's coming. So that's what they're supposed to do. Moses and Aaron went and did it just as God had told them to do. And this happened at the time when Moses was 80 years old and Aaron was 83 years old. Incredible. And Moses thought he was all done at 40. Okay, there's just a couple things that I want to point out, and then we should have plenty of time for any questions. There's a Chinese writer, I can't remember his name, he wrote The Art of Warfare. And he made a statement, know your enemy and know yourself. This is a book in which he is explaining how to fight wars. And one of his maxims is, know your enemy and know yourself. That's critical when you go into warfare. And that's an often repeated maxim. Other people have said it since then. What's interesting to me is, in this situation, Pharaoh didn't know his enemy. That is, he didn't know the Israelites. He didn't know Moses and Aaron. He didn't know the God who had sent them. And he doesn't know himself. So what happens when Moses and Aaron come to him and say, God wants us to go out and sacrifice to him. Let us go out and sacrifice to him. Pharaoh doesn't inquire to learn, who is this God who wants you to go out and sacrifice to him? He doesn't inquire as to why they think this is important or anything like that. Pharaoh knows already, at least he thinks he knows already, what the situation is. He's already decided that what's going on here is we have a rebellion. We have a rebellion that's being led by Moses and Aaron, and they just want to get them out from under their heavy burden of labor. They're lazy. And as a result, Pharaoh has decided that the appropriate action for me to take is to use overwhelming force, that is, be particularly strict and hard on them and bring them in line. Had he really understood the situation, he would have given up. He would have understood that resistance was futile, that Yahweh was behind this, and Yahweh was going to accomplish his purposes. But Pharaoh was given over to a blindness. He can't see it. And as a result, he keeps pursuing that same course, and his stubbornness is going to make it impossible for him to see what's going on and adjust his strategy. But that's exactly what God wanted to happen, and that sets the stage for God's dramatic acts to free his people. The second thing I'd like to point out is the extent to which patience is a huge part of a life of faith. If you look at what this thing that Moses has gone through, his experience, that there have been several times where things have moved along and then things go sour. And it looks like things are not progressing. And it looks like things have gone off course. And God is not accomplishing what he said he would accomplish. But in the long run, God is going to bring that back around. In the long run, God is going to accomplish everything that he said he was going to accomplish. I've used this illustration before for other purposes, but it helps me. The Oregon coast goes north and south. If you started out at Astoria and you followed the coastline, it would take you to California, which is south of Oregon. But there could be places along that line, if you're walking down the coast, where you are actually walking north. There are times you go east or west, but there are times you could even be going north before you turn around and go south more consistently. And that's the life, that's the nature of this thing that God involves us in, of life. That there are times when it can look like things are going in the opposite direction of what they should be going, even in the opposite direction of what God may have promised. But in fact, God knows what he's doing, and in the long run, we're all headed south. In the long run, that's where we're going, even though it may not look like it. And that is certainly what we see Moses experiencing. Things have gone haywire a couple of times here, and Moses is just having to be patient and wait until God accomplishes the purposes that he wants to accomplish. From our perspective, it can look like things are crazy and chaotic, but what God is actually doing is very complex and multifaceted, And in order to accomplish his purposes, it can look like things are chaotic, but they aren't. God knows what he's doing, and he's accomplishing those purposes. As a result, our response has to be one of patience. Just give God time to do what he's doing and accomplish what he wants to accomplish. Okay, so at this point then, the text, there's a bit of a break in the text, and what's going to follow is God is going to begin this process of inflicting the plagues on the Pharaoh and the people of Egypt, and he's going to bring his people out in the Exodus. So we'll pick that up when I start again next stint. We have lots of time for questions, if there are any questions.
Along the lines of what you just shared, would it seem to be relatively a truism to say that we people, we humans, who so often have such great desire to know and to understand, in a sense, all of reality, or in other words, God himself, confounds us through all of reality, so that our great desire to know is not preeminent, but ultimately we are challenged to obey or trust rather than to know. Mm-hmm. And is that part of what you're saying?
Yes. My only concern is that it would be possible, I think, to be too pessimistic about our ability to know anything. Because it's the thing that's critical is that we understand that we are mortal creatures and God is the transcendent creator. And we can know to the extent that God reveals to us. He made us to be knowers, and he has revealed things to us. But we can't know beyond what he reveals to us. And there is a vast amount that he has not revealed to us, and perhaps will not. And so as a result, making sense of our experience, oftentimes God has not given us what we need to know to be able to fully understand what his purposes are. That's often the case. In fact, in my experience, that's almost always the case. And so it's just a matter of acting on faith, like you say. That's the situation that he's put us in. If you think of all of the aspects of what it means to be a creature who has been created, there are a lot of different parts to that. But as believers, it is our job to understand what our place is and to be comfortable in that place. We know what God reveals to us to know, but what's beyond that, we can't know. And that's got to be okay with us.
You said be comfortable in that place.
Well, comfort is a relative term. What I mean by that is understand it and bow our knee to God and say, I may not like it, but fine by me, because I understand that you're in control of the bigger picture, and I trust you ultimately.
Yeah, and isn't the lack of comfort maybe the second wave reality in our lack of comfort in not being able to know and therefore not being able to imagine that we have some power or control that just as effectively wears into our and bears down on our presumptions that we do have power?
Absolutely.
And it's like the second attack, the second wave.
Yeah.
And once again, we say, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You know.
Right. It seems to me that all life long, we are learning what it means to be in our place as creature.
This is rather a minor question, but it's a translation. Chapter 6, verse 1 and 2. You used the word from your translation, compunction, whereas mine says my mighty hand. I mean, it definitely
yes.
says that God's
yes.
mighty hand will
right.
do it.
Right.
And I
right.
just wondered if it is that personal or if it is more of a under compunction.
My mighty hand, it would be a closer translation. But I think the idea is my overwhelming force. It won't be because of the Pharaoh's willingness, but it will be a result of God entirely.
Jacob's name, God started calling him Israel, right? So in 6:3, where he says Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then in 6, he goes back to the sons of Israel instead of saying the sons of Jacob.
Right.
Is that significant?
Well, I think it is. It is not clear what the etymology of the name Jacob is, but the name Israel is given to Jacob after he has wrestled with the angel. And so what we see in the name Israel, we see this determination to wrestle with God and get the blessing that God has promised. So it is the sons of Israel, it's not the sons of Jacob. So it's in that capacity, I think, that we are supposed to see the descendants of Jacob, that ultimately they will do the same thing that Jacob did. they will be turned into a people that desperately want the blessings from God that he has promised to them. So you don't see, when they're referred to as a people, you don't see sons of Jacob used, sons of Israel.
He grew up, so to speak. And you're not the sons of the younger Jacob. You're the sons of the older Israel.
Right.
Changed.
He developed, he matured, and there is a sense in which his descendants are going to follow that pattern, and they will reach that same place of being ones who strive with God in the positive sense of striving with God. They will strive with God all the way through, but ultimately strive with God out of a desire of wanting those blessings that God has promised.
So it seems like their names are much more important than our names in our culture. It's their names describe them.
Mm-hmm.
And when they change enough, their name changes, like Pliny the Elder, as opposed to Pliny the Younger. Well, that makes a distinction between those two guys, but doesn't really...
Right, right. There's Pliny Senior and Pliny Junior is essentially what it is. Right. Like I said with the gods, they can have several names. Well, people can have several names too, and they are... Those names are not just the name that some grandfather had, but they are usually given as names of significance, that is, names that somehow capture the nature of the person.
Charles Martel, the hammer of God. And then that's what they called him.
Right. But then you can use the different names depending on what aspect of that person you want to highlight, just as you can with the gods.
This really should be listened to by a person in that culture at that time, because there's a whole lot between the on the paper that you just don't get.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. And that's the challenge for us, is to try to figure out as best we can what that is, what all the cultural background for this is.
Thanks, David. I can understand why the genealogy would occur after an episode where Moses' leadership is questioned. Do you think there's any reason why it's placed after this specific instance of his leadership being questioned? And also, is there any significance in it coming before the signs and plagues?
I think what's happened, this is information that the author wants to include, feels is important to include, that is the genealogy of Moses. Who are they? So this is coming back to the question, who are they? And wants to identify them. And wanted to identify them after the stage is set for the plagues, but before the main event, that is the plagues themselves. So it's coming right before those start. That's where the author chose to take that little break to do it. But as you say, it's also to highlight these acts of rebelliousness against God and Moses are not going to end here. They're going to persist throughout the Pentateuch, actually.
Okay, so I had a thought before I had a chance to look it up. So maybe I'm just going to say it and pretend that it's true, and you can tell me that, no, you're not reading it right. Is the way it happened before the genealogy, the repetition that you're talking about, Moses says, I'm unskilled in speech, at which point we have the genealogy, which highlights Moses and Aaron, and then we have the repetition, I'm unskilled in speech, and now after having heard the genealogy, now God says, and Aaron's going to be like you're going to be like God, and he's going to be like your prophet. I was just crossed my mind that one thing that the genealogy does is it highlights both of them in that spot and kind of sets you up for, in this story of the plagues, that Moses and Aaron are going to be playing this role, and these are the guys that are going to be playing that role.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, thanks.